She went past the rear door. Through the four glass panes in the upper half, she saw a back porch, a green yard, a couple of big trees, and the barn. Without any architectural division, the kitchen opened into the dining area, and the combined space was probably two-thirds the width of the house. The round dinette table was dark pine, supported by a thick central drum rather than legs. The four heavy pine captain's chairs featured tie-on back and seat cushions. Upstairs, the music started again, but it was softer in the kitchen than in the front room. If she had been an aficionado of big band music, however, she would have been able to recognize the tune from here. The noise of the running shower was more apparent in the kitchen than in the living room, because the pipes were channeled through the rear wall of the old house. Water being drawn upward to the bathroom made an urgent, hollow, rushing sound through copper. Furthermore, the pipe wasn't tied down and insulated as well as it ought to have been, and at some point along its course, it vibrated against a wall stud, rapid knocking behind plasterboard, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. If that noise abruptly stopped, she would know that her safe time in the house was limited. In the subsequent silence, she could count on no more than a minute or two of grace while he toweled off. Thereafter, he might show up anywhere. China looked around for a telephone, but saw only a wall jack into which one could be plugged. If there had been a phone, she might have paused to call 911, supposing there was 911 service out here in, well, wherever the hell they were, these boondocks. Knowing that help was on the way would have made the remainder of the search less nerve-wracking. At the north end of the dining area was another door. Although the killer was in the shower upstairs, she turned the knob as quietly as she could and crossed the threshold with caution. Beyond lay a combination laundry and storage room, a washer, an electric dryer. Boxes and bottles of laundry supplies were stored in an orderly fashion on two open shelves, and the air smelled like detergent and bleach. The rush of water and the knocking pipe were even louder here than they had been in the kitchen. To the left, past the washer and dryer, was another door, rough pine painted lime green. She opened it and saw stairs leading down to a black cellar, and her heart began to beat faster.
"Ariel?"
she said softly, but there was no answer, because she had spoken more to herself than to the girl. No windows at all below, not even a turbid leak of gray stormlight seeping through narrow casements or screened ventilation cutouts. Dungeon dark. But if the bastard was keeping a girl down there, how odd that he wouldn't have added a lock to this upper door. It offered only the spring latch that retracted with a twist of the knob, not a real lock of any kind. The captive might be sealed in a windowless room deep below, of course, or even manacled. Ariel might have no hope of reaching these stairs and this upper door, even if left alone for days to worry at her restraints, which would explain why the killer was confident that one more barrier to her flight wasn't necessary, even when he was away from home. Nevertheless, it seemed peculiar that he wouldn't be concerned about a thief breaking into the house when he was gone, descending to the cellar, and inadvertently discovering the imprisoned girl. Considering the obvious age of the structure, its rusticity, and the lack of any apparent alarm keypads, China doubted that the house had a security system. The killer, with all his secrets, ought to have installed a steel door to the cellar, with locks as impregnable as those on a bank vault. The lack of special security might mean that the girl, Ariel, was not here. China didn't want to dwell on that possibility. She had to find Ariel. Leaning through the doorway, she felt along the stairwell wall for the switch and snapped it up. Lights came on, both at the upper landing and in the basement. The bare concrete steps, a single flight, were steep. They appeared to be much newer than the house itself, perhaps even a relatively recent addition. The high-velocity surge of water through plumbing and the hard wrapping of the loose pipe in the wall told her that the killer was still busy in the bathroom above, scrubbing away all traces of his crimes. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Louder than before, but still in a whisper, she said,
"Ariel!"
Out of the still air below, no response. Louder.
"Ariel!"
Nothing. China didn't want to go down into this windowless pit, with no way out except the stairs, even with a lockless door above, but she couldn't think of any way to avoid the descent, not if she was to learn for sure whether Ariel was here. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. It always came to this. Even with childhood long past and being grown up and everything supposedly in control, everything supposedly all right, even then it still came to this. Alone, dizzy with fear, alone, down into a bleak, dark, cramped place. No exits, sustained only by mad hope, with the world indifferent, no one to wonder about her or care where she might have gone. Listening intently for the slightest change in the sound of the rushing water and the vibrating pipe, China went down one step at a time, her left hand on the iron railing. The gun was extended in her right hand. She was clenching it so fiercely that her knuckles ached. "China Shepherd, untouched and alive," she said shakily. "China Shepherd, untouched and alive." Halfway down the stairs, she glanced back and up. At the end of a trail of her wet shoe prints, the landing seemed a quarter of a mile above her, as far away as the top of the knoll had seemed from the front porch of the house. Alice down the rabbit hole into a madness without tea parties. At the open doorway between the in-kitchen dining area and the laundry room, Mr. Edgler Vess hears the mystery woman call to Ariel. She is only a few feet away from him, around the corner, past the washer and the dryer, so there can be no mistake about what name she speaks. Ariel. Stupefied, he stands blinking and open-mouthed in the fragrance of laundry detergent and in the wall-muffled rattle of copper pipes, with her voice echoing in memory. There is no way for her to know about Ariel. Yet she calls to the girl again, louder than before. Mr. Vess suddenly feels terribly violated, oppressed, observed. He glances back at the windows in the dining area and the kitchen, expecting to discover the radiant faces of accusing strangers pressed to those panes. He sees only the rain and the drowned gray light, but he is still anguished. This is not fun any longer. Not fun at all. The mystery is too deep and alarming. It is as if this woman didn't come to him out of that Honda, but came through an invisible barrier between dimensions out of some world beyond this one from which she has been secretly watching him. The flavor is distinctly supernatural, the texture otherworldly, and now the laundry detergent smells like burning incense, and the cloying air seems thick with unseen presences. Fearful and plagued by doubt, unaccustomed to both of those emotions, Mr. Vess steps into the laundry room, raising the Heckler & Koch P7. His finger wraps the trigger, already beginning to squeeze off a shot. The cellar door stands open. The stairwell light is on. The woman is not in sight. He eases off the trigger without firing. On those infrequent occasions when he has guests to the house to dinner or for a business meeting, he always leaves a Doberman in the laundry room. The dog lies in here, silent and dozing, but if anyone other than Vess were to enter, the dog would bark and snarl and drive him backward. When the master is away, Dobermans vigilantly patrol the entire property, and no one has a hope of getting into the house itself, let alone into the cellar. Mr. Vess has never put a lock on the door to the cellar steps because he is concerned that it might accidentally trip, imprisoning him down there when he is at play and unawares. With a key-operated deadbolt, of course, this catastrophe could never happen. He himself is incapable of imagining how any such mechanism could malfunction and trap him. Nevertheless, he's too concerned about the prospect to take the risk. Over the years, he has seen coincidence at work in the world and people perishing because of it. One late June afternoon near dusk, as Mr. Vess was driving to Reno, Nevada, on Interstate 80, a young blonde in a Mustang convertible had passed his motorhome. She was wearing white shorts and a white blouse, and her long hair streamed red-gold in the twilight wind. Filled with an instant and powerful need to smash her beautiful face, he had pressed the motorhome to its limits to keep her swifter Mustang in sight, but his quest had seemed doomed. As the highway rose into the Sierras, the speed of the motorhome had fallen and the Mustang had pulled away. Even if he had been able to draw even with the woman, the traffic had been too heavy, too many witnesses, for him to try anything as bold as forcing her off the highway. Then one of the tires on the Mustang had blown. Traveling at such high speed, she nearly spun out, nearly rolled, swerved from lane to lane, blue smoke pouring off the tires. But then she got control and pulled the car off the road onto the shoulder. Mr. Vess had stopped to assist her. She had been grateful for his offer of help, smiling and pleasantly shy, a nice girl with a 1-inch gold cross on a chain around her neck, and later she had wept so bitterly and struggled so excitingly to resist surrendering her beauty, to turn her face away from his various sharp instruments, just a high-spirited young woman full of life and on the way to Reno until coincidence gave her to him. And if a blown tire, why not a malfunctioning lock? If coincidence can give, it can take. Mr. Vess lives with intensity, but not without caution. Now this woman, calling for Ariel, has come into his life, like a blown tire. And suddenly he's not sure if she is a gift to him, or he to her. Remembering her revolver and wishing for Doberman's, he glides across the laundry room to the cellar door. The woman's voice rises from the stairs below. China Shepherd, untouched and alive. The words are so strange, the meaning so mysterious, that they seem to be an incantation, encoded and cryptic. Confirming that perception, the woman repeats herself as though she is chanting, China Shepherd, untouched and alive. Though Vess is not usually superstitious, he experiences a heightened sense of the supernatural beyond anything he's felt thus far. His scalp prickles and the flesh on the nape of his neck crawls, and his hand tightens on the pistol. After a hesitation, he leans through the open door and looks down the cellar stairs. The woman is only a few steps from the bottom. She's got one hand on the railing, the revolver held out in front of her in the other hand. Not a cop. An amateur. Nonetheless, she might be Mr. Vess's blown tire, and he's jumpy, twitchy, still extremely curious about her, but prepared to put his safety ahead of his curiosity. He eases through the doorway onto the upper landing. Even as close as she is, she does not hear him because all is concrete, nothing to creak. He aims his pistol at the center of her back. The first shot will catapult her off her feet, send her flying with her arms spread toward the basement below, and the second shot will take her as she is in flight. Then he'll race down the stairs behind her, firing the third and fourth rounds, hitting her in the legs if possible. He'll drop on top of her, press the muzzle into the back of her head, and then, when he's totally in control of her, dominant, he can decide whether she's still a threat or not, whether he can risk questioning her or whether she's so dangerous that nothing will do but to put a couple of rounds in her brain. As the woman passes under the light near the foot of the stairs, Mr. Vess gets a better look at her revolver. It is indeed a Smith & Wesson 38 Chiefs special, as he had thought earlier, when he had seen it from the second-floor bedroom window, but suddenly the make and model of the weapon have electrifying meaning for him. He smells a Slim Jim sausage. He remembers Liquid Night eyes widening in shock, terror, and despair. He has seen two of these guns in the past several hours. The first belonged to the young Asian gentleman at the service station, who drew it from under the counter in self-defense but never had the opportunity to fire. Although the Chief's Special is a popular revolver, it is not so universally admired that one sees it everywhere in use. Edgler Vess knows, with the certainty of a fox on the scent of a rabbit in the weeds, that this is the same gun. Although there are still many mysteries about the woman on the stairs below him, though her presence here is no less astonishing to him than it was before, there is nothing supernatural about her. She knows the name Ariel not because she has been watching from some world beyond this one, not because she is in the dutiful service of some higher force, but simply because she must have been there, in the service station, when Vess was chatting up the two clerks and when moments later he killed them. Where she could have been hiding, how he could have overlooked her, why she would feel the need to pursue him, where she got all the courage for this reckless adventure. These are things he can't discern through intuition alone. But now he will have the opportunity to put these questions to her. Lowering his pistol, he steps back into the laundry room, lest she glance up the stairs and see him. His uncharacteristic fear, his eerie perception of oppressive supernatural forces, lifts like a fog from him, and he is amazed by his own brief spasm of gullibility. He who has no illusions about the nature of existence, he who is so clear-seeing, he who knows the primacy of pure sensation, even he, the most rational of all men, has spooked. He almost laughs at his foolishness, and at once puts it out of his mind. The woman must be to the bottom of the stairs by now. He will allow her to explore. After all, for whatever bizarre reasons, this is what she has come here to do. And Vess is curious about her reactions to the things that she discovers. He is having fun again. Once more. The game is on. Chyna reached the bottom of the stairs. The outer wall of mortared stone was to her right. There was nowhere to go in that direction. To her left was a chamber about 10 feet from front to back and as wide as the house. She moved away from the foot of the stairs into this new space. At one end stood an oil-fired furnace and a large electric water heater. At the other end were tall metal storage cabinets with vent slits in the doors, a workbench and a tool chest on wheels. Directly ahead, in a concrete block wall, a strange door waited. Click! Whoosh! Chyna swung to the right and almost squeezed off a shot before she realized that the sound had come from the furnace, the electric pilot light clicking on, fuel taking flame. Over the sound of the furnace, she was still able to hear the vibrating pipe. Tata-tata-tata. It was fainter here than on the stairs, but still audible. She could barely make out the music from the second-floor bathroom, an inconstant thread of melody, primarily the passages in brass or wailing clarinet. Evidently for soundproofing, the door in the back wall was padded like a theater door, in leather-grain maroon vinyl divided into quilt-like squares by 8 upholstery nails with large round heads covered in matching vinyl. The frame was upholstered in the same material. No lock, not even a spring latch, prevented her from proceeding. Putting her hand on the vinyl, Chyna discovered that the padding was even more plush than it appeared to be. As much as 2 inches of foam covered the underlying wood. She gripped the long stainless steel U-shaped handle. When she pulled, the vinyl-encased door softly scraped and squeaked across the upholstery on the jamb. The fit was snug. When the door swung all the way free of the jamb and the seal was broken, there was a faint sound similar to that made when one opened a jar of vacuum-packed peanuts. The door was upholstered on the inside as well. The overall thickness was in excess of 5 inches. Beyond this new threshold lay a 6-foot square chamber with a low ceiling, which reminded her of an elevator, except that every surface other than the floor was upholstered. The floor was covered with a rubber mat of the kind used in many restaurant kitchens for the comfort of cooks who worked on their feet for hours at a time. In the dim light from the recessed overhead bulb, she saw that the fabric here wasn't vinyl but gray cotton with a nubbly texture. The strangeness of the place sharpened her fear, yet at the same time she was so sure that she understood the purpose of the padded vestibule that her stomach rolled with faint nausea. Directly opposite the door the Chyna held open was one more door. It was also padded and set in an upholstered frame. Finally, here were locks. The gray upholstery plumped around 2 heavy-duty brass lock cylinders. She couldn't proceed without keys. Then she noticed a small padded panel overlaying the door itself, at eye level perhaps 6 by 10 inches with a knob attached. It was like the sliding panel over the viewport in the solid door of a maximum security prison cell. Tata, tata, tata. The killer seemed to be taking an unusually long shower. On the other hand, Chyna hadn't been in the house more than 3 minutes. It just seemed longer. If he was having a leisurely scrub, he might not be half done. Tata, tata. She would have preferred to hold open the outer door while she stepped into the vestibule and slid aside the panel on the inner viewport, but the distance was too great. She had to let the door fall shut behind her. The moment that the upholstered door met the upholstered jamb with a whisper squeak of softly abraded vinyl, Chyna could no longer hear the vibrating water pipe. The quiet was so profound that even her ragged breathing was barely audible. Under the padding, the walls must have been covered with layers of sound-attenuating insulation. Or perhaps the killer had shut off the shower just as the door had fallen shut and was now toweling dry, or pulling on a robe without bothering to towel off, on his way downstairs. Fearful, unable to breathe, she opened the door again. Tata, 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 and the rush of water moving at high velocity under pressure. She exhaled explosively with relief. She was still safe. All right, okay, be cool, keep moving, find out if the girl is here, and then do what has to be done. Reluctantly, she allowed the door to fall shut. The rattling of the pipe was again sealed out. She felt as though she was suffocating. Perhaps ventilation in the vestibule was inadequate, but it was the sound-deafening effect of the padded walls, at least as much as poor airflow, that made the atmosphere seem as thick as smoke and unbreathable. Chyna slid aside the padded panel on the inner door. Beyond was rose-colored light. The port was fitted with a sturdy screen to protect the viewer from assault by whomever or whatever was within. Chyna put her face to the port and saw a large chamber nearly the size of the living room under which it was situated. In portions of the space, shadows were pool deep, and the only light came from three lamps with fringed fabric shades and pink bulbs that were each putting out about 40 watts. At two places along the back wall were panels of red and gold brocade that hung from brass rods as if covering windows, but there could be no windows underground. The brocade was just set dressing to make the room more comfortable. On the wall to the left, barely touched by light, was a large, tattered tapestry, a scene of women in long dresses and cloche hats, riding horses side-saddle through spring grass and flowers past a verdant forest. The furnishings included a plump armchair with antimacassars, a double bed with a white headboard painted with a scene not quite discernible in the rose light, bookcases with acanthus leaf molding, cabinets with mullioned doors, a small dining table with a heavily carved apron, two directoire chairs with flower pattern upholstery flanking the table, and a refrigerator. An immense darkly stained armoire, featuring crackle-glazed flower appliques on all the door panels, was old but probably not a genuine antique, battered but handsome. A padded vanity bench sat before a makeup table with a triptych mirror in a gilded, fluted frame. In a far corner was a toilet and a sink. As weird as this subterranean room was, like a storage vault for the stage furniture from a production of arsenic and old lace, the collection of dolls was by far the strangest thing about it. Cupid dolls, Cabbage Patch Kids, Raggedy Ann, and numerous other varieties, both old and new, some more than 3 feet tall, some smaller than a milk carton, were dressed in diapers, snowsuits, elaborate bridal dresses, checkered rompers, cowboy outfits, tennis togs, pajamas, hula skirts, kimonos, clown suits, overalls, nighties, and sailor suits. They filled the bookshelves, peered out through the glass doors of some of the cabinets, perched on the armoire, sat atop the refrigerator, stood and sat on the floor along the walls. Others were piled atop one another in a corner and at the foot of the bed, legs and arms jutting at odd stiff angles, heads cocked as on broken necks, like stacks of gaily attired corpses awaiting transport to a crematorium. 200 or 300 or more small faces either glowed in the gentle light or were ghost pale in the shadows, some of bisque and some of china and some of cloth, some wood and some plastic. Their glass, tin, button, cloth, and painted ceramic eyes reflected the light, shone brightly where the dolls were placed near any of the three lamps, glowed as moodily as banked coals where they were consigned to the darker corners. For a moment, China was half convinced that these dolls could actually see, except for a few individuals who appeared to be blind behind cataracts of rose light, and that awareness glimmered in their terrible eyes. Although none of them moved, or even shifted their gazes, they had an aura of life about them. Their power was uncanny, as though the killer were also a warlock who stole the souls of those he murdered and imprisoned them in these figures. Then quiet movement in the room, a shadow coming out of gloom, proved to be the captive, and when she stepped into sight, the dolls lost their eerie magic. She was the most beautiful child that China had ever seen, more beautiful even than in the Polaroid snapshot, with straight, lustrous hair that was an enchanting shade of auburn in the peculiar light, though platinum blonde in reality. Fine-boned, slender, graceful, she possessed a beauty that was ethereal, angelic, and she seemed to be not a real girl, but an apparition bearing a message about redemption, a manger, hope, and a guiding star. She was dressed in black penny loafers, white knee socks, a blue or black skirt, and a short-sleeved white blouse with dark piping on the collar and across the pocket flap, as though she was in the uniform of a parochial school. No doubt the killer provided the girl with the clothes that he wished her to wear, and China saw at once why he would favor outfits like this. Though physically she was undoubtedly 16, she seemed younger when dressed in this fashion, with her slender arms, with her delicate wrists and hands. In this blushing light, the demure uniform made her seem like a child of 11, shy of her confirmation Sunday, naive and innocent. Sociopaths like this man were drawn to beauty and to innocence because they were compelled to defile it. When innocence was stripped away, when beauty was cut and crushed, the malformed beast could at last feel superior to this person he had coveted. After the innocent and the beautiful were left dead and rotting, the world was to some degree made to resemble more closely the killer's interior landscape. The girl sat in the armchair. She was holding a book. She opened it, turned a few pages, and appeared to read. Although she had surely heard the panel sliding back from the viewport in the door, she did not look up. Apparently, she assumed that her visitor was, as always, the eater of spiders. With a rush of emotion that pinched her heart and surprised her with its intensity, China said, "Ariel!" The name fell through the port as into an airless void, having carried no distance whatsoever, creating no echo. The girl's cell obviously had been lined with numerous layers of soundproofing, perhaps with even more layers than the vestibule, and all this attention to the containment of her shouts and screams seemed to indicate that from time to time the killer invited people into his house, perhaps to dinner, or to have a few beers and watch a football game. That he would dare such a thing was only one more proof of his outrageous boldness. But that he would have friends at all chilled China, friends not demented like him, who would be horrified to discover the girl in his cellar and to know that their host slaughtered whole families for his entertainment. He passed for human in the workaday world. People laughed at his jokes, sought his advice, shared their joys and sorrows with him. Perhaps he attended church? On some Saturday nights did he go dancing, smoothly two-stepping around the floor with a smiling woman in his arms, keeping time to the same music that everyone else heard? China raised her voice. "Ariel!" The girl failed to look up. Louder still, all but shouting it through the screened port in the padded door. "Ariel!" In the chair, knees primly together, the book in her lap, head bowed to the page, wings of hair hiding most of her face, Ariel sat as if deaf. Or as if she were a girl in the back of a closet, tuning out the shouted arguments of drunk and drug-sodden adults, tuning out further and further until she was in a great, deep, silent place of her own, untouchable. China recalled times as a young girl when simply hiding from her mother and her mother's more dangerous friends had not provided her with a sufficient sense of security. Sometimes the arguments or the celebrations became too violent or too boisterous. The chaos of noise and crazy laughter and cursing spun like a tornado around her even where she had concealed herself, and her fear spiraled out of control until she thought that her heart would burst or her head explode. Then she went away to more welcoming places in her mind, through the back of the old wardrobe into the land of Narnia, which she had read about in the wonderful books of Mr. C.S. Lewis, or to visit Toad Hall and the wild wood from The Wind in the Willows, or into realms that she herself invented. She had always been able to come back from those escapements, but on occasion she had thought about how wonderful it would be to stay in that faraway place, where neither her mother nor her mother's kind would ever be able to find her again, no matter how hard they looked. In those exotic kingdoms, there was often danger, but there were also true and faithful friends, like none found on this side of magical wardrobes. Now, peering through the screened port at the girl in the chair, China was sure that Ariel had sought refuge in just such a far place, and was detached from this sorry world in every way that counted. After a year in this dismal hole, from time to time suffering the attentions of the sociopath upstairs, perhaps she had wandered so far along the road of inner adventure that she could not easily, or ever, return. In fact, the girl raised her gaze from the book and sat staring neither at China's face in the doorport, nor apparently at anything in the room, but at something in a world twice removed from this one. Even in the inadequate rose light, China could see that Ariel's eyes were out of focus, and as strange as the eyes of any of the dolls that surrounded her. The killer had told the men at the service station that he had not yet touched Ariel in that way, and China believed him. Because once he had taken her innocence, he would need to smash her beauty, and when that was done, he would kill her. The fact that she was alive argued that she was still untouched. Yet day after day, month after dreadful month, she had lived in exhausting suspense, waiting for the hateful son of a bitch to decide that she was ripe, waiting for his brutal assault, his sour breath on her face, his hot and insistent hands, the terrible, irresistible weight of him, every indignity and humiliation. In her single room, there had been nowhere to hide. She could not escape to the rooftop, to the beach, to the attic, to the crawl space, to the upper limbs of the tree in the backyard.
Ariel!
The refuge to which she had escaped might be in the pages of the book that she now held. She functioned in this world, grooming and feeding and bathing and dressing herself, but she lived in some other dimension. China's heart rolled in a sea of sorrow in a storm of rage, and through the port in the upholstered door she said, "I'm here, Ariel. I'm here. You aren't alone anymore." Ariel's gaze didn't shift out of dreams, and she was as still as any of the dolls. "I am your guardian, Ariel. I'll keep you safe."